years before the Civil War got rolling. What Eddie had discovered about Tower during their palaver was dismaying. He harbored some respect for the man, for any man who could hold out for more than 20 seconds against Balazar's goons, but didn't like him much. There was a kind of willful stupidity about him. Eddie thought it was self-created and maybe propped up by his analyst, who would tell him about how he had to take care of himself, how he had to be the captain of his own ship, the author of his own destiny, respect his own desires, all that blah, blah. All the little code words and terms that meant it was all right to be a selfish fuck. That it was noble, even. When Tower told Eddie that Aaron Deepno was his only friend, Eddie wasn't surprised. What surprised him was that Tower had any friends at all. Such a man could never be Ka-Tet, and it made Eddie uneasy to know that their destinies were so tightly bound together.
You'll just have to trust to Ka. It's what Ka's for, isn't it?
Sure it was. But Eddie didn't have to like it. 14. Eddie asked if Tower had a ring with Ex-Liveris on it. Tower looked puzzled, then laughed and told Eddie he must mean Ex-Libris. He rummaged on one of his shelves, found a book, showed Eddie the plate in front. Eddie nodded.
No, Tower said, but it'd be just the thing for a guy like me, wouldn't it?
He looked at Eddie keenly. Why do you ask? But Tower's future responsibility to save a man now exploring the hidden highways of multiple Americas was a subject Eddie didn't feel like getting into right now. He'd come as close to blowing the guy's mind as he wanted to, and he had to get back through the unfound door before Black 13 wore Roland away to a frazzle.
Never mind, but if you see one, you ought to pick it up. One more thing and then I'm gone.
What's that?
I want your promise that as soon as I leave, you'll leave.
Tower once more grew shifty. It was the side of him Eddie knew he could come to outright loathe, given time.
Why, to tell you the truth, I don't know if I can do that. Early evenings are often a very busy time for me. People are much more prone to browse once the workday is over, and Mr. Bryce is coming in to look at a first of The Troubled Air, Irwin Shaw's novel about radio in the McCarthy era. I'll have to at least skim through my appointment calendar and...
He droned on, actually gathering steam as he descended toward trivialities. Eddie said very mildly,
Do you like your balls, Calvin? Are you maybe as attached to them as they are to you?
Tower, who'd been wondering about who would feed Sergio if he just pulled up stakes and ran, now stopped and looked at him, puzzled, as if he had never heard this simple, one-syllable word before. Eddie nodded helpfully.
You're nuts. You're sack. You're stones. You're cojones. The old sperm firm. Your testicles.
I don't see what... Eddie's coffee was gone. He poured some half and half into the cup and drank that instead. It was very tasty.
I told you that if you stayed here, you could look forward to a serious maiming. That's what I meant. That's probably where they'll start with your balls, to teach you a lesson. As to when it happens, what that mostly depends on is traffic.
Traffic. Tower said it with a complete lack of vocal expression.
That's right, Eddie said, sipping his half and half as if it were a thimble of brandy. Basically, how long it takes Jack Andolini to drive back out to Brooklyn, and then how long it takes Balazar to load up some old beater of a van or panel truck with guys to come back here. I'm hoping Jack's too dazed to just phone.
Did you think Balazar'd wait until tomorrow, convene a little brain trust of guys like Kevin Blake and Chimmy Dretto to discuss the matter? Eddie raised first one finger and then two. The dust of another world was beneath the nails.
First, they got no brain. Second, Balazar doesn't trust him. What he'll do, Cal, is what any successful despot does. He'll react right away, quick as a flash. The rush hour traffic will hold him up a little, but if you're still here at 6, half past at the latest, you can say goodbye to your balls. They'll hack them off with a knife, then cauterize the wound with one of those little torches, those burns-o-matics.
Stop, Tower said. Now, instead of white, he'd gone green, especially around the gills.
I'll go to a hotel down in the village. There are a couple of cheap ones that cater to writers and artists down on their luck. Ugly rooms, but not that bad. I'll call Aaron, and we'll go north tomorrow morning.
Fine. But first you have to pick a town to go to, Eddie said, because I, or one of my friends, may need to get in touch with you.
How am I supposed to do that? I don't know any towns in New England north of Westport, Connecticut.
Make some calls once you get to the hotel in the village, Eddie said. You pick the town, and then tomorrow morning before you leave New York, send your pal Aaron up to your vacant lot. Have him write the zip code on the board fence.
An unpleasant thought struck Eddie.
You have zip codes, don't you? I mean, they've been invented, right?
Tower looked at him as if he were crazy.
Of course they have. Okay, have him put it on the 46th Street side, all the way down where the fence ends. Have you got that?
Yes, but
they probably won't have your bookshop staked out tomorrow morning. They'll assume you got smart and blue. But if they do, they won't have the lot staked out. And if they have the lot staked out, it'll be the 2nd Avenue side. And if they have the 46th Street side staked out, they'll be looking for you, not him.
Tower was smiling a little bit in spite of himself. Eddie relaxed and smiled back.
But if they're also looking for Aaron? Have him wear the sort of clothes he doesn't usually wear. If he's a blue jeans man, have him wear a suit. If he's a suit man, have him wear blue jeans.
Correct.
And sunglasses wouldn't be a bad idea, assuming the day isn't cloudy enough to make them look odd. Have him use a black felt tip. Tell him it doesn't have to be artistic. He just walks to the fence as if to read one of the posters. Then he writes the numbers and off he goes. And tell him, for Christ's sake, don't fuck up.
And how are you going to find us once you get to zip code whatever? Eddie thought of Tooks and their palaver with the Falcon as they sat in the big porch rockers, letting anyone who wanted to have a look and ask a question.
Go to the local general store, have a little conversation, tell anyone who's interested that you're in town to write a book or paint pictures of the lobster pots. I'll find you.
All right, Tower said. It's a good plan. You do this well, young man.
I was made for it, Eddie thought, but didn't say. What he said was, I have to be going. I've stayed too long as it is.
There's one thing you have to help me do before you go, Tower said, and explained. Eddie's eyes widened. When Tower had finished, it didn't take long. Eddie burst out,
Ah, you're shitting.
Tower tipped his head toward the door to his shop, where he could see that faint shimmer. It made the passing pedestrians on 2nd Avenue look like momentary mirages.
There's a door there. You as much as said so, and I believe you. I can't see it, but I can see something.
You're insane, Eddie said. Totally gonzo.
He didn't mean it, not precisely. But less than ever he liked having his fate so firmly woven into the fate of a man who'd make such a request, such a demand.
Maybe I am and maybe I'm not, Tower said.
He folded his arms over his broad but flabby chest. His voice was soft, but the look in his eyes was adamant.
In either case, this is my condition for doing all that you say, for falling in with your madness, in other words.
Ah, Cal, for God's sake. God and the man Jesus, I'm only asking you to do what Stephen Torrens' will told you to do.
The eyes did not soften or cut aside as they did when Tower was waffling or preparing to fib. If anything, they grew stonier yet.
Stephen Torrens' dead, and I'm not. I've told you my condition for doing what you want. The only question is whether or not—
Yeah, 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 Eddie cried and drank off the rest of the white stuff in his cup.
Then he picked up the carton and drained that for good measure. It looked like he was going to need the strength.
Come on, he said. Let's do it.
15. Roland could see into the bookshop, but it was like looking at things on the bottom of a fast-running stream. He wished Eddie would hurry. Even with the bullets buried deep in his ears, he could hear the Todash chimes, and nothing blocked the terrible smells. Now hot metal, now rancid bacon, now ancient melting cheese, now burning onions. His eyes were watering, which probably accounted for at least some of the wavery look of things seen beyond the door. Far worse than the sound of the chimes or the smells was the way the ball was insinuating itself into his already compromised joints, filling them up with what felt like splinters of broken glass. So far, he'd gotten nothing but a few twinges in his good left hand, but he had no illusions. The pain there and everywhere else would continue to increase for as long as the box was open and Black 13 shone out unshielded. Some of the pain from the dry twist might go away once the ball was hidden again, but Roland didn't think all of it would. And this might only be the beginning. As if to congratulate him on his intuition, a baleful flare of pain settled into his right hip and began to throb there. To Roland, it felt like a bag filled with warm liquid lead. He began to massage it with his right hand, as if that would do any good.
"Roland!"
The voice was bubbly and distant. Like the things he could see beyond the door, it seemed to be underwater, but it was unmistakably Eddie's. Roland looked up from his hip and saw that Eddie and Tower had carried some sort of case over to the unfound door. It appeared to be filled with books.
"Roland, can you help us?"
The pain had settled so deeply into his hips and knees that Roland wasn't even sure he could get up. But he did it, and fluidly. He didn't know how much of his condition Eddie's sharp eyes might have already seen, but Roland didn't want them to see any more, not at least until their adventures in Calabrin Sturgis were over.
"When we push it, you pull."
Roland nodded his understanding, and the bookcase slid forward. There was one strange and vertiginous moment when the half in the cave was firm and clear, and the half still back in the Manhattan bookstore of the mind shimmered unsteadily. Then Roland took hold of it and pulled it through. It juddered and squalled across the floor of the cave, pushing aside little piles of pebbles and bones. As soon as it was out of the doorway, the lid of the ghostwood box began to close. So did the door itself.
"No, you don't," Roland murmured. "No, you don't, you bastard."
He slipped the remaining two fingers of his right hand into the narrowing space beneath the lid of the box. The door stopped moving and remained ajar when he did. And enough was enough. Now even his teeth were buzzing. Eddie was having some last little bit of palaver with Tower, but Roland no longer cared if they were the secrets of the universe.
"Eddie," he roared. "Eddie, to me."
And thankfully, Eddie grabbed his swag bag and came. The moment he was through the door, Roland closed the box. The unfound door shut a second later with a flat and undramatic clap. The chimes ceased. So did the jumble of poison pain pouring into Roland's joints. The relief was so tremendous that he cried out. Then, for the next 10 seconds or so, all he could do was lower his chin to his chest, close his eyes, and struggle not to sob.
"Say thank you," he managed at last. "Eddie, say thank you."
"Don't mention it. Let's get out of this cave. What do you think?"
"I think yes," Roland said. "Gods, yes."
16. "Didn't like him much, did you?" Roland asked. 10 minutes had passed since Eddie's return. They had moved a little distance down from the cave, then stopped where the path twisted through a small rocky inlet. The roaring gale that had tossed back their hair and plastered their clothes against their bodies was here reduced to occasional prankish gusts. Roland was grateful for them. He hoped they would excuse the slow and clumsy way he was building his smoke. Yet he felt Eddie's eyes upon him, and the young man from Brooklyn, who had once been almost as dull and unaware as Andolini and Biondi, now saw much.
"Tower, you mean?"
Roland tipped him a sardonic glance.
"Of whom else would I speak, the cat?"
Eddie gave a brief grunt of acknowledgement, almost a laugh. He kept pulling in long breaths of the clean air. It was good to be back. Going to New York in the flesh had been better than going toe-dash in one way. That sense of lurking darkness had been gone, and the accompanying sense of thinness. But God, the place stank. Mostly it was cars and exhaust. The oily clouds of diesel were the worst, but there were 1,000 other bad smells, too. Not the least of them was the aroma of too many human bodies, their essential polecat odor not hidden at all by the perfumes and sprays the Falcon put on themselves. Were they unconscious of how bad they smelled, all huddled up together as they were? Eddie supposed they must be.
had been himself once upon a time. Once upon a time, he couldn't wait to get back to New York, would have killed to get there. Eddie, come back from this. Roland snapped his fingers in front of Eddie Dean's face.
I'm sorry, he said. As for Tower, no, I didn't like him much. God, sending his books through like that, making his lousy first editions part of his condition for helping to save the fucking universe.
He doesn't think of it in those terms. Unless he does so in his dreams. And you know they'll burn his shop when they get there and find him gone. Almost surely. Pour gasoline under the door and light it. Break his window and toss in a grenade, either manufactured or homemade. Do you mean to tell me that never occurred to you? Of course it had.
Well, maybe.
It was Roland's turn to utter the humorous grunting sound. Not much may in that be. So he saved his best books. And now in Doorway Cave, we have something to hide the pair's treasure behind. Although I suppose it must be counted our treasure now. His courage didn't strike me as real courage, Eddie said. It was more like greed. Not all are called to the way of the sword or the gun or the ship, Roland said, but all serve Ka.
Really? Does the Crimson King? Or the low men and women Callahan talked about?
Roland didn't reply. Eddie said,
He may do well, Tower, I mean, not the cat.
Very amusing, Roland said dryly. He scratched a match on the seat of his pants, cupped the flame, lit his smoke.
Thank you, Roland. You're growing in that respect. Ask me if I think Tower and Deepno can get out of New York City clean.
Do you?
No. I think they'll leave a trail. We could follow it, but I'm hoping Balazar's men won't be able to. The one I worry about is Jack Andolini. He's creepy smart. As for Balazar, he made a contract with this Sombra Corporation.
Took the king's salt.
Yeah, I guess somewhere up the line he did, Eddie said. He had heard king instead of king, as in Crimson King. Balazar knows that when you make a contract, you have to fill it or have a damn good reason why not. Fail and word gets out. Stories start to circulate about how so-and-so's going soft, losing his shit. They've still got 3 weeks to find Tower and force him to sell the lot to Sombra. They'll use it. Balazar's not the FBI, but he is a connected guy, and... Roland, the worst thing about Tower is that in some ways, none of this is real to him. It's like he's mistaken his life for a life in one of his storybooks. He thinks things have got to turn out all right because the writer's under contract.
You think he'll be careless?
Eddie voiced a rather wild laugh. Oh, I know he'll be careless. The question is whether or not Balazar will catch him at it.
We're going to have to monitor Mr. Tower. Mind him for safety's sake. That's what you think, isn't it?
You're bugger, Eddie said, and after a moment's silent consideration, both of them burst out laughing. When the fit had passed, Eddie said, I think we ought to send Callahan if he'll go. You probably think I'm crazy, but
not at all, Roland said. He's one of us. Or could be. I felt that from the first, and he's used to traveling in strange places. I'll put it to him today. Tomorrow I'll come up here with him and see him through the doorway.
Let me do it, Eddie said. Once was enough for you, at least for a while.
Roland eyed him carefully, then pitched his cigarette over the drop. Why do you say so, Eddie?
Your hair's gotten whiter up around here, Eddie patted the crown of his own head. Also, you're walking a little stiff. It's better now, but I'd guess the old rheumatiz kicked in on you a little. Fess up.
All right, I fess, Roland said. If Eddie thought it was no more than old Mr. Rheumatiz, that was not so bad.
Actually, I could bring him up tonight long enough to get the zip code, Eddie said. It'll be day again over there, I bet.
None of us is coming up this path in the dark. Not if we can help it.
Eddie looked down the steep incline to where the fallen boulder jutted out, turning 15 feet of their course into a tightrope walk. Point taken.
Roland started to get up. Eddie reached out and took his arm.
Stay a couple of minutes longer, Roland, do you?
Roland sat down again, looking at him. Eddie took a deep breath, let it out.
Ben Sleitman's dirty, he said. He's the tattletale. I'm almost sure of it.
Yes, I know.
Eddie looked at him wide-eyed. You know?
How could you possibly... Let's say I suspected. How?
His spectacles, Roland said. Ben Sleitman the Elder's the only person in Kala Bryn Sturgis with spectacles. Come on, Eddie. Day's waiting. We can talk as we walk. XVII. They couldn't, though, not at first, because the path was too steep and narrow. But later, as they approached the bottom of the mesa, it grew wider and more forgiving. Talk once more became practical, and Eddie told Roland about the book, the Dogon or the Hogan, and the author's oddly disputable name. He recounted the oddity of the copyright page, not entirely sure that Roland grasped this part, and said it had made him wonder if something was pointing toward the sun, too. That seemed like a crazy idea, but I think that if Benny Sleitman was helping his father inform on us, Roland said, Jake would know. Are you sure he doesn't? Eddie asked. This gave Roland some pause. Then he shook his head. Jake suspects the father. He told you that? He didn't have to. They had almost reached the horses, who raised their heads alertly and seemed glad to see them. He's out there at the Rocking Bee, Eddie said. Maybe we ought to take a ride out there, invent some reason to bring him back to the pears. He trailed off, looking at Roland closely. No?
No.
Why not?
Because this is Jake's part of it.
That's hard, Roland. He and Benny Sleitman like each other, a lot. If Jake ends up being the one to show the Kala what his dad's been doing,
Jake will do what he needs to do, Roland said. So will we all.
But he's still just a boy, Roland. Don't you see that?
He won't be for much longer, Roland said, and mounted up. He hoped Eddie didn't see the momentary wince of pain that cramped his face when he swung his right leg over the saddle. But of course, Eddie did. Chapter 3. The Dogon, Part 2. 1. Jake and Benny Sleitman spent the morning of that same day moving hay bales from the upper lofts of the Rocking Bee's three inner barns to the lower lofts, then breaking them open. The afternoon was for swimming and water fighting in the Hwy, which was still pleasant enough if one avoided the deep pools. Those had grown cold with the season. In between these two activities, they ate a huge lunch in the bunkhouse with half a dozen of the hands, not Sleitman the Elder. He was off at Telford's Buckhead Ranch, working a stock trade.
I ain't seen that boy of Ben's work so hard in my life,
Cookie said as he put fried chops down on the table and the boys dug in eagerly.
You'll wear him plumb out, Jake.
That was Jake's intention, of course. After haying in the morning, swimming in the afternoon, and a dozen or more barn jumps for each of them by the red light of evening, he thought Benny would sleep like the dead. The problem was he might do the same himself. When he went out to wash at the pump, sunset come and gone by then, leaving ashes of roses deepening to true dark, he took Oi with him. He splashed his face clean and flicked drops of water for the animal to catch, which he did with great alacrity. Then, Jake dropped to one knee and gently took hold of the sides of the Billy Bumbler's face.
Listen to me, Oi.
Oi.
I'm going to go to sleep, but when the moon rises, I want you to wake me up, quietly. Do you ken?
Ken.
Which might mean something or nothing. If someone had been taking wagers on it, Jake would have bet on something. He had great faith in Oi, or maybe it was love, or maybe those things were the same. When the moon rises. Say moon, Oi.
Moon.
Sounded good, but Jake would set his own internal alarm clock to wake him up at moonrise, because he wanted to go out to where he'd seen Benny's Da and Andy that other time. That queer meeting worried at his mind more rather than less as time went by. He didn't want to believe Benny's Da was involved with the wolves, Andy either, but he had to make sure, because it was what Roland would do. For that reason, if no other. 2.
The two boys lay in Benny's room. There was one bed, which Benny had, of course, offered to his guest, but Jake had refused it. What they'd come up with instead was a system by which Benny took the bed on what he called even-hand nights, and Jake took it on odd-hand nights. This was Jake's night for the floor, and he was glad. Benny's goose-down-filled mattress was far too soft. In light of his plan to rise with the moon, the floor was probably better, safer. Benny lay with his hands behind his head, looking up at the ceiling. He had coaxed Oi up onto the bed with him, and the bumbler lay sleeping in a curled comma, his nose beneath his cartoon squiggle of a tail.
"Jake?"
A whisper.
"You asleep?"
"No."
"Me neither."
A pause.
"It's been great having you here."
"It's been great for me," Jake said, and meant it. "Sometimes being the only kid gets lonely."
"Don't I know it? And I was always the only one."
Jake paused.
"Bet you were sad after your sister died."
"Sometimes I'm still sad."
At least he said it in a matter-of-fact tone, which made it easier to hear.
"Reckon you'll stay after you beat the wolves?"
"Probably not long."
"You're on a quest, aren't you?"
"I guess so."
"For what?"
The quest was to save the Dark Tower in this wear, and the Rose in the New York wear he and Eddie and Susanna had come from. But Jake did not want to say this to Benny, much as he liked him. The Tower and the Rose were kind of secret things, the Cotette's business. But neither did he want to lie.
"Roland doesn't talk about stuff much," he said.
A longer pause, the sound of Benny shifting, doing it quietly so as not to disturb Oi.
"He scares me a little, your din."
Jake thought about that, then said,
"He scares me a little, too. He scares my pa."
Jake was suddenly very alert.
"Really?"
"Yes, he says it wouldn't surprise him if, after you got rid of the wolves, you turned on us. Then he said he was just joking, but that the old cowboy with the hard face scared him. I reckon that must have been your din, don't you?"
"Yeah," Jake said.
Jake had begun thinking Benny had gone to sleep when the other boy asked,
"What was your room like back where you came from?"
Jake thought of his room, and at first found it surprisingly hard to picture. It had been a long time since he'd thought of it, and now that he did, he was embarrassed to describe it too closely to Benny. His friend lived well indeed by Kala standards. Jake guessed there were very few small-hold kids Benny's age with their own rooms, but he would think a room such as Jake could describe that of an enchanted prince. The television? The stereo with all his records? And the headphones for privacy? His posters of Stevie Wonder and the Jackson Five, his microscope, which showed him things too small to see with the naked eye. Was he supposed to tell this boy about such wonders and miracles?
"It was like this, only I had a desk,"
Jake said at last.
"A writing desk?"
Benny got up on one elbow.
"Well, yeah,"
Jake said, the tone implying, "Sheesh, what else?"
"Paper? Pens? Quill pens?"
"Paper,"
Jake agreed. Here, at least, was a wonder Benny could understand.
"And pens, but not quill. Ball."
"Ball pens?
I don't understand."
So Jake began to explain, but halfway through he heard a snore. He looked across the room and saw Benny still facing him, but now with his eyes closed. Oi opened his eyes, they were bright in the darkness, then winked at Jake. After that, he appeared to go back to sleep. Jake looked at Benny for a long time, deeply troubled in ways he did not precisely understand or want to. At last, he went to sleep himself. 3. Some dark, dreamless time later, he came back to a semblance of wakefulness because of pressure on his wrist. Something pulling there, almost painful.
Teeth.
Oi's.
"Oi, no, quit it,"
he mumbled, but Oi would not stop. He had Jake's wrist in his jaws and continued to shake it gently from side to side, stopping occasionally to administer a brisk tug. He only quit when Jake finally sat up and stared dopily out into the silver-flooded night.
"Moon,"
Oi said.
He was sitting on the floor beside Jake, jaws open in an unmistakable grin, eyes bright. They should have been bright, a tiny white stone burned deep down in each one.
Moon?
Yeah, Jake whispered, and then closed his fingers around Oi's muzzle.
Hush!
He let go and looked over at Benny, who was now facing the wall and snoring deeply. Jake doubted if a howitzer shell would wake him.
Moon,
Oi said much more quietly. Now he was looking out the window.
Moon, moon, moon.
4. Jake would have ridden bareback, but he needed Oi with him, and that made bareback difficult, maybe impossible. Luckily, the little border pony Cy Overholzer had loaned him was as tame as a tabby cat, and there was a scuffy old practice saddle in the barn's tack room that even a kid could handle with ease. Jake saddled the horse, then tied his bedroll behind to the part Kala Cowboys called the boat. He could feel the weight of the Ruger inside the roll, and, if he squeezed, the shape of it as well. The duster with the commodious pocket in the front was hanging on a nail in the tack room. Jake took it, whipped it into something like a fat belt, and cinched it around his middle. Kids in his school had sometimes worn their outer shirts that way on warm days. Like those of his room, this memory seemed far away, part of a circus parade that had marched through town and then left. That life was richer. A voice deep in his mind whispered. This one is truer, whispered another, even deeper. He believed that second voice, but his heart was still heavy with sadness and worry as he led the border pony out through the back of the barn and away from the house. Oi padded along at his heel, occasionally looking up at the sky and muttering,
Moon, moon,
but mostly sniffing the crisscrossing scents on the ground. This trip was dangerous. Just crossing Divar Titi Hwai, going from the Kala side of things to the Thunderclap side, was dangerous, and Jake knew it. Yet what really troubled him was the sense of looming heartache. He thought of Benny, saying it had been great to have Jake at the Rocking Bee to chum around with. He wondered if Benny would feel the same way a week from now.
Doesn't matter, he sighed. It's Ka.
Ka,
Oi said, then looked up.
Moon. Ka, moon. Moon, Ka.
Shut up, Jake said, not unkindly.
Shut up, Ka,
Oi said amiably.
Shut up, moon. Shut up, ache. Shut up, Oi.
It was the most he'd said in months, and once it was out, he fell silent. Jake walked his horse another 10 minutes, past the bunkhouse and its mixed music of snores, grunts, and farts, then over the next hill. At that point, with the east road in sight, he judged it safe to ride. He unrolled the duster, put it on, then deposited Oi in the pouch, and mounted up. 5. He was pretty sure he could go right to the place where Andy and Sleitman had crossed the river, but reckoned he'd only have one good shot at this, and Roland would have said pretty sure wasn't good enough in such a case. So he went back to the place where he and Benny had tented instead, and from there to the jut of granite which had reminded him of a partially buried ship. Once again, Oi stood panting into his ear. Jake had no problem sighting on the round rock with the shiny surface. The dead log that had washed up against it was still there, too, because the river hadn't done anything but fall over the last weeks. There'd been no rain whatever, and this was something Jake was counting on to help him. He scrambled back up to the flat place where he and Benny had tented out. Here, he'd left his pony tethered to a bush. He led it down to the river, then scooped up Oi and rode across. The pony wasn't big, but the water still didn't come up much higher than his fetlocks. In less than a minute, they were on the far bank. It looked the same on this side, but wasn't. Jake knew it right away. Moonlight or no moonlight, it was darker somehow. Not exactly the way Todash, New York had been dark, and there were no chimes, but there was a similarity just the same. A sense of something waiting, and eyes that could turn in his direction if he was foolish enough to alert their owners to his presence. He had come to the edge of Endworld. Jake's flesh broke out in goosebumps, and he shivered. Oi looked up at him.
It's all right, Jake whispered. Just had to get it out of my system. He dismounted, put Oi down, and stowed the duster in the shadow of the round rock. He didn't think he'd need a coat for this part of his excursion. He was sweating, nervous. The babble of the river was loud, and he kept shooting glances across to the other side, wanting to make sure no one was coming. He didn't want to be surprised. That sense of presence of others was both strong and unpleasant. There was nothing good about what lived on this side of the Divar Titi Whai. Of that much, Jake was sure. He felt better when he'd taken the docker's clutch out of the bedroll, cinched it in place, and then added the Ruger. The Ruger made him into a different person, one he didn't always like. But here, on the far side of the Whai, he was delighted to feel gun weight against his ribs and delighted to be that person, that gunslinger. Something farther off to the east screamed like a woman in life-ending agony. Jake knew it was only a rock cat. He'd heard them before when he'd been at the river with Benny, either fishing or swimming. But he still put his hand on the butt of the Ruger until it stopped. Oi had assumed the bowing position, front paws apart, head lowered, rump pointed skyward. Usually this meant he wanted to play, but there was nothing playful about his bared teeth.
"It's okay," Jake said.
He rummaged in his bedroll again. He hadn't bothered to bring a saddlebag until he found a red-checked cloth. This was Slightman the Elder's neckerchief, stolen 4 days previous from beneath the bunkhouse table where the foreman had dropped it during a game of Watch Me and then forgotten it.
"Quite the little thief I am," Jake thought. "My dad's gun? Now Benny's dad's snot rag. I can't tell if I'm working my way up or down."
It was Roland's voice that replied. "You're doing what you were called here to do. Why don't you stop beating your breast and get started?" Jake held the neckerchief between his hands and looked down at Oi.
"This always works in the movies," he said to the bumbler. "I have no idea if it works in real life, especially after weeks have gone by."
He lowered the neckerchief to Oi, who stretched out his long neck and sniffed it delicately.
"Find this smell, Oi. Find it and follow it. Oi."
But he just sat there looking up at Jake.
"This, Dumbo," Jake said, letting him smell it again. "Find it. Go on."
Oi got up, turned around twice, then began to saunter north along the bank of the river. He lowered his nose occasionally to the rocky ground, but seemed a lot more interested in the occasional dying woman howl of the rock cat. Jake watched his friend with steadily diminishing hope. Well, he'd seen which way Slightman had gone. He could go in that direction himself, course around a little, see what there was to see. Oi turned around, came back toward Jake, then stopped. He sniffed a patch of ground more closely. The place where Slightman had come out of the water? It could have been. Oi made a thoughtful hoofing sound far back in his throat and then turned to his right, east. He slipped sinuously between two rocks. Jake, now feeling at least a tickle of hope, mounted up and followed. 6. They hadn't gone far before Jake realized Oi was following an actual path that wound through the hilly, rocky, arid land on this side of the river. He began to see signs of technology, a cast-off, rusty electrical coil, something that looked like an ancient circuit board poking out of the sand, tiny shards and shatters of glass. In the black moonlight-created shadow of a large boulder, he spied what looked like a whole bottle. He dismounted, picked it up, poured out God knew how many decades or centuries of accumulated sand, and looked at it. Written on the side in raised letters was a word he recognized. Nozzola.
"The drink of finer bum hugs everywhere," Jake murmured and put the bottle down again.
Beside it was a crumpled-up cigarette pack. He smoothed it out, revealing a picture of a red-lipped woman wearing a jaunty red hat. She was holding a cigarette between two glamorously long fingers. Party appeared to be the brand name. Oi, meanwhile, was standing 10 or 12 yards farther along and looking back at him over one low shoulder.
"Okay," Jake said. "I'm coming."
Other paths joined the one they were on, and Jake realized this was a continuation of the East Road.
He could see only a few scattered boot prints and smaller, deeper footprints. These were in places guarded by high rocks, wayside coves the prevailing winds didn't often reach. He guessed the boot prints were Sleitman's, the deep footprints, Andy's. There were no others. But there would be, and not many days from now, either. The prints of the wolves' gray horses coming out of the east. They would also be deep prints, Jake reckoned. Deep like Andy's. Up ahead, the path breasted the top of a hill. On either side were fantastically misshapen organ pipe cactuses with great thick barrel arms that seemed to point every which way. Oi was standing there, looking down at something and once more seeming to grin. As Jake approached him, he could smell the cactus plants. The odor was bitter and tangy. It reminded him of his father's martinis. He sat astride his pony beside Oi, looking down. At the bottom of the hill on the right was a shattered concrete driveway. A sliding gate had been frozen half open ages ago, probably long before the wolves started raiding the borderland collars for children. Beyond it was a building with a curved metal roof. Small windows lined the side Jake could see, and his heart lifted at the sight of the steady white glow that came through them. Not Seeners, and not light bulbs either, what Roland called spark lights. Only fluorescence threw that kind of white light. In his New York life, fluorescent lights made him think mostly of unhappy, boring things, giant stores where everything was always on sale and you could never find what you wanted. Sleepy afternoons at school when the teacher droned on and on about the trade routes of ancient China or the mineral deposits of Peru, and rain poured endlessly down outside, and it seemed the closing bell would never ring. Doctor's offices where you always wound up sitting on a tissue-covered exam table in your underpants, cold and embarrassed and somehow positive that you would be getting a shot. Tonight, though, those lights cheered him up. Good boy! He told the bumbler. Instead of responding as he usually did by repeating his name, Oi looked past Jake and commenced a low growl. At the same moment, the pony shifted and gave a nervous whinny. Jake reined him, realizing that bitter but not entirely unpleasant smell of gin and juniper had gotten stronger. He looked around and saw two spiny barrels of the cactus tangle on his right swiveling slowly and blindly toward him. There was a faint grinding sound, and dribbles of white sap were running down the cactus's central barrel. The needles on the arms, swinging toward Jake, looked long and wicked in the moonlight. The thing had smelled him, and it was hungry. Come on, he told Oi, and booted the pony's sides lightly. The pony needed no further urging. It hurried downhill, not quite trotting, toward the building with the fluorescent lights. Oi gave the moving cactus a final, mistrustful look, then followed them. 7. Jake reached the driveway and stopped. About 50 yards farther down the road, it was now very definitely a road, or had been once upon a time, train tracks crossed and then ran on toward the Divar-Titi-Y, where a low bridge took them across. The Folkin called that bridge the Causeway. The older Folkin, Callahan had told them, called it the Devil's Causeway. The trains that bring the Runt ones back from Thunderclap come on those tracks, he murmured to Oi. And did he feel the tug of the beam? Jake was sure he did. He had an idea that when they left Calabrin Sturgis, if they left Calabrin Sturgis, it would be along those tracks. He stood where he was a moment longer, feet out of the stirrups, then headed the pony up the crumbling driveway toward the building. To Jake, it looked like a Quonset hut on a military base. Oi, with his short legs, was having hard going on the broken-up surface. That busted-up paving would be dangerous for his horse, too. Once the frozen gate was behind them, he dismounted and looked for a place to tether his mount. There were bushes close by, but something told him they were too close, too visible. He led the pony out onto the hardpan, stopped, and looked around at Oi.
Stay. Stay, Oi. Ache.
Jake found more bushes behind a pile of boulders like a strew of huge and eroded toy blocks. Here he felt satisfied enough to tether the pony. Once it was done, he stroked the long, velvety muzzle.
"Not long," he said. "Can you be good?"
The pony blew through his nose and appeared to nod, which meant exactly nothing, Jake knew. And it was probably a needless precaution anyway. Still, better safe than sorry. He went back to the driveway and bent to scoop the bumbler up. As soon as he straightened, a row of brilliant lights flashed on, pinning him like a bug on a microscope stage. Holding Oi in the curve of one arm, Jake raised the other to shield his eyes. Oi whined and blinked. There was no warning shout, no stern request for identification, only the faint snuffle of the breeze. The lights were turned on by motion sensors, Jake guessed. What came next? Machine gun fire directed by dipolar computers? A scurry of small but deadly robots like those Roland, Eddie, and Susanna had dispatched in the clearing where the beam they were following had begun? Maybe a big net dropping from overhead like in this jungle movie he'd seen once on TV. Jake looked up. There was no net. No machine guns either. He started walking forward again, picking his way around the deepest of the potholes and jumping over a washout. Beyond this ladder, the driveway was tilted and cracked, but mostly whole.
"You can get down now," he told Oi. "Boy, you're heavy. Watch out or I'll have to stick you in Weight Watchers."
He looked straight ahead, squinting and shielding his eyes from the fierce glare. The lights were in a row, running just beneath the Quonset's curved roof. They threw his shadow out behind him, long and black. He saw rock cat corpses, two on his left and two more on his right. Three of them were little more than skeletons. The fourth was in a high state of decomposition, but Jake could see a hole that looked too big for a bullet. He thought it had been made by a bob bolt. The idea was comforting. No weapons of super science at work here. Still, he was crazy not to be hightailing it back toward the river and the collar beyond it, wasn't he?
"Crazy," he said.
"Crazy,"
Oi said, once more padding along at Jake's heel. A minute later, they reached the door of the hut. Above it, on a rusting steel plate, was this: North Central Positronics Limited. Northeast Corridor, Arc Quadrant, Outpost 16, Medium Security. Verbal entry code required. On the door itself, now hanging crooked by only two screws, was another sign. A joke? Some sort of nickname? Jake thought it might be a little of both. The letters were choked with rust and eroded by God knew how many years of blowing sand and grit, but he could still read them. Welcome to the Dogon. 8. Jake expected the door to be locked and wasn't disappointed. The lever handle moved up and down only the tiniest bit. He guessed that when it had been new, there'd been no give in it at all. To the left of the door was a rusty steel panel with a button and a speaker grill. Beneath it was the word Verbal. Jake reached for the button, and suddenly the lights lining the top of the building went out, leaving him in what at first seemed like utter darkness.
"They're on a timer," he thought, waiting for his eyes to adjust. "A pretty short one, or maybe they're just getting tired, like everything else the old people left behind."
His eyes readapted to the moonlight, and he could see the entry box again. He had a pretty good idea of what the verbal entry code must be. He pushed the button.
"Welcome to Arc Quadrant, Outpost 16, said a voice.
Jake jumped back, stifling a cry. He had expected a voice, but not one so eerily like that of Blaine the Mono. He almost expected it to drop into a John Wayne drawl and call him Little Trailhand.
"This is a medium security outpost. Please give the verbal entry code. You have 10 seconds. 9, 8,
19, Jake said.
"Incorrect entry code. You may retry once. 5, 4, 3,
99, Jake said.
"Thank you."
The door clicked open. 9. Jake and Oi walked into a room that reminded him of the vast control area Roland had carried him through beneath the city of Ludd, as they had followed the steel ball which had guided them to Blaine's cradle. This room was smaller, of course, but many of the dials and panels looked the same. There were chairs at some of the consoles, the kind that would roll along the floor so that the people who worked here could move from place to place without getting to their feet. There was a steady sigh of fresh air, but Jake could hear occasional rough rattling sounds from the machinery driving it. And while three-quarters of the panels were lighted, he could see a good many that were dark. Old and tired. He had been right about that. In one corner was a grinning skeleton in the remains of a brown khaki uniform. On one side of the room was a bank of TV monitors. They reminded Jake a little bit of his father's study at home. Although his father had had only three screens, one for each network, and here there were, he counted, 30. Three of them were fuzzy, showing pictures he couldn't really make out. Two were rolling rapidly up and up as if the vertical hold had fritzed out. Four were entirely dark. The other 21 were projecting pictures, and Jake looked at these with growing wonder. Half a dozen showed various expanses of desert, including the hilltop guarded by the two misshapen cactuses. Two more showed the outpost, the Dogon, from behind and from the driveway side. Under these were three screens showing the Dogon's interior. One showed a room that looked like a galley or kitchen. The second showed a small bunkhouse that looked equipped to sleep eight. In one of the bunks, an upper, Jake spied another skeleton. The third, inside the Dogon screen, presented this room from a high angle. Jake could see himself and Oi. There was a screen with a stretch of the railroad tracks on it, and one showing the little Y from this side, moonstruck and beautiful. On the far right was the causeway with the train tracks crossing it. It was the images on the other eight operating screens that astounded Jake. One showed Took's general store, now dark and deserted, closed up till daylight. One showed the pavilion. Two showed the Kala High Street. Another showed Our Lady of Serenity Church. And one showed the living room of the rectory. Inside the rectory, Jake could actually see the pair's cat, Snugglebutt, lying asleep on the hearth. The other two showed angles of what Jake assumed was the Manny village. He had not been there. Where in hell's name are the cameras? Jake wondered. How come nobody sees them? Because they were too small, he supposed. And because they'd been hidden. Smile, you're on candid camera. But the church, the rectory, those were buildings that hadn't even existed in the Kala until a few years previous. And inside? Inside the rectory? Who would put a camera there and when? Jake didn't know when, but he had a terrible idea that he knew who. Thank God they'd done most of their palavering on the porch or outside on the lawn. But still, how much must the wolves or their masters know? How much had the infernal machines of this place, the infernal fucking machines of this place, recorded and transmitted? Jake felt pain in his hands and realized they were tightly clenched, the nails biting into his palms. He opened them with an effort. He kept expecting the voice from the speaker grill, the voice so much like Blaine's, to challenge him, ask him what he was doing here. But it was mostly silent in this room of not-quite-ruin, no sounds but the low hum of the equipment and the occasionally raspy whoosh of the air exchangers. He looked over his shoulder at the door and saw it had closed behind him on a pneumatic hinge. He wasn't worried about that. From this side, it would probably open easily. If it didn't, good old 99 would get him out again. He remembered introducing himself to the Foken that first night in the pavilion, a night that already seemed a long time ago. "I am Jake Chambers, son of Elmer, the line of Eld," he had told them. "The Ka-Tet of the 99." Why had he said that? He didn't know. All he knew was that things kept showing up again. In school, Miss Avery had read them a poem called "The Second Coming" by William Butler Yeats. There had been something in it about a hawk turning and turning in a widening gyre, which was, according to Miss Avery, a kind of circle. But here, things were in a spiral, not a circle. For the Ka-Tet of 19
or of the 90 and 9, Jake had an idea they were really the same, things were tightening up even as the world around them grew old, grew loose, shut down, shed pieces of itself. It was like being in the cyclone which had carried Dorothy off to the land of Oz, where witches were real and bumhugs ruled. To Jake's heart, it made perfect sense that they should be seeing the same things over and over, and more often, because... Movement on one of the screens caught his eye. He looked at it and saw Benny's Da and Andy the Messenger Robot coming over the hilltop guarded by the cactus sentries. As he watched, the spiny barrel arms swung inward to block the road and, perhaps, impale the prey. Andy, however, had no reason to fear cactus spines. He swung an arm and broke one of the barrels off halfway down its length. It fell into the dust, spurting white goo. Maybe it wasn't sap at all, Jake thought. Maybe it was blood. In any case, the cactus on the other side swiveled away in a hurry. Andy and Ben Sleitman stopped for a moment, perhaps to discuss this. The screen's resolution wasn't clear enough to show if the human's mouth was moving or not. Jake was seized by an awful, throat-closing panic. His body suddenly seemed too heavy, as if it were being tugged by the gravity of a giant planet like Jupiter or Saturn. He couldn't breathe. His chest lay perfectly flat. This is what Goldilocks would have felt like, he thought in a faint and distant way, if she had awakened in the little bed that was just right to hear the three bears coming back in downstairs. He hadn't eaten the porridge, he hadn't broken Baby Bear's chair, but he now knew too many secrets. They boiled down to one secret. One monstrous secret. Now they were coming down the road. Coming to the Dogon. Oi was looking up at him anxiously, his long neck stretched to the max, but Jake could barely see him. Black flowers were blooming in front of his eyes. Soon he would faint. They would find him stretched out here on the floor. Oi might try to protect him, but if Andy didn't take care of the bumbler, Ben Sleitman would. There were 4 dead rock cats out there, and Benny's Da had dispatched at least one of them with his trusty Ba. One small, barking billy bumbler would be no problem for him. Would you be so cowardly, then? Roland asked inside his head. But why would they kill such a coward as you? Why would they not just send you west with the broken ones who have forgotten the faces of their fathers? That brought him back, most of the way at least. He took a huge breath, yanking in air until the bottoms of his lungs hurt. He let it out in an explosive whoosh. Then he slapped himself across the face, good and hard.
Ache!
Oi cried in a reproving, almost shocked voice.
It's okay, Jake said.
He looked at the monitors showing the galley and the bunkroom and decided on the ladder. There was nothing to hide behind or under in the galley. There might be a closet, but what if there wasn't? He'd be screwed.
Oi, to me,
he said, and crossed the humming room beneath the bright white lights. 10. The bunk room held the ghostly aroma of ancient spices, cinnamon and clove. Jake wondered, in a distracted back-of-the-mind way, if the tombs beneath the pyramids had smelled this way when the first explorers had broken into them. From the upper bunk in the corner, the reclining skeleton grinned at him as if in welcome. Feel like a nap, little trail hand? I'm taking a long one. Its ribcage shimmered with silky overlays of spiderweb, and Jake wondered in that same distracted way how many generations of spider babies had been born in that empty cavity. On another pillow lay a jawbone, prodding a ghostly, ghastly memory from the back of the boy's mind. Once, in a world where he had died, the gunslinger had found a bone like that and used it. The forefront of his mind pounded with 2 cold questions and 1 even colder resolve. The questions were how long it would take them to get here and whether or not they would discover his pony. If Sleitman had been riding a horse of his own, Jake was sure the amiable little pony would have whinnied a greeting already. Luckily, Sleitman was on foot, as he had been last time. Jake would have come on foot himself had he known his goal was less than a mile east of the river. Of course, when he'd snuck away from the rocking bee, he hadn't even been sure that he had a goal. The resolve was to kill both the Tin Man and the Flesh and Blood Man if he was discovered.
If he could, that was. Andy might be tough, but those bulging blue glass eyes looked like a weak point. If he could blind him.
"There'll be water if God wills it," said the gunslinger who now always lived in his head for good and ill. "Your job now is to hide if you can. Where?"
"Not in the bunks. All of them were visible in the monitor covering.